I'm Susan Montanaro, and you're listening to Dreams and Detours, a show about the life we plan to have versus the one we're living, for better or not. Everybody has a story, and I believe we find ourselves in each other's stories. Hi, it's Susan Montanaro. Last month, I had the chance to speak with Diane DiResta, an executive speaking coach and the author of Knockout Presentations. Diane trains corporate leaders and groups to be influential public speakers. We had a great conversation about her early beginnings, the detours she had, and the great lessons she learned in order to become a master leader and speaker herself. Please welcome Diane DiResta.
Okay, and welcome to the show, Diane DiResta. So happy to have you here today.
And I'm thrilled to be here.
Just so we can quickly address and let the audience know, we are coming to you today via a Zoom video call. And while this is not unusual for me to do at times, in light of the current dynamic with the virus that's spreading across the world, we knew that this was the best way for us to get together to have our conversation about Diane and her dreams and detours. And so that's where we are today.
And what we want to do is make this go viral. So how fitting.
How fitting.
But, you know, it's allowed us, the technology, the blessing right now is that we already are set up with technology so that we can continue to do a lot of what we were doing before. And even though we aren't communicating face-to-face in person, we can still stay connected. So I'm grateful for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you're right. Fortunately, with everyone trying to take a self-imposed quarantine, we will be able to utilize these tools and not feel so far away. Yes. So thank you for doing that with me today. So Diane, I know that, you know, part of the reason that I really wanted to talk to you and talk about your story today, one part is all the work that you do now as an executive speech coach, really taking leaders into that next place of great success by helping them to present and articulate their message in a way that not only resonates with their audience, but really brings them to the point of success and to the end goal that they have in their minds and kind of bringing it out through their mouth. I want to talk a little bit about how your background began in speech pathology and how that has rolled up into your current profession today.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned speech pathology, which was my first profession. When I look back, way back into childhood, I always corrected people's speech. I don't know why I did that. What happened was I grew up initially on military bases. So even though we are native New Yorkers from Brooklyn, I never had a Brooklyn accent because my teammates, my classmates were Southern and Midwestern. So I lived in Germany twice. When I came back, people commented on that. And so I had a very attuned ear from the beginning. And so I was always keying into people's speech. But when I went to college, my goal originally was to be an English teacher. English was my favorite subject. I loved it, straight A's, but there were no teaching jobs at the time, and I had to find something else. So I took my first required public speaking class. It was there, the professor talked about speech pathology as a profession. And I thought, that's interesting. Let me check it out. And so I took a few courses, liked it. And it was similar to what I would have been doing as an English teacher. It was still teaching people, but
kind of correcting them, if you will, and guiding them.
Yes. Right. You know, it's English, speech, et cetera. And so that's how I got started doing that. And so I graduated, I went on to graduate school, and my first position was at the Board of Education in New York City in Brooklyn. And that wasn't my intention. My intention was always, was to be more clinical. I wanted to work with aphasics, which are stroke patients.
Okay.
And here's a detour. There was a recession, so there were no jobs really. And so the Board of Ed was hiring. So I went for it because I wanted to work in my profession. And I ended up staying there about 8.5 years. What happened, again, because when I look at my past, I say, you don't want to follow my career path because there were a lot of detours. So here I was on my path. I had my first job full-time in my profession. I had just moved into my first apartment ever. I think I was 23 or 24.
Right. That's exciting.
Yes. It was a beautiful brownstone in Brooklyn Heights, beautiful tree-lined street, big studio apartment, double closets. And I was also going to Columbia Graduate School at night. So things were
living your dream. Really.
Yes, I was
your plan
on my
was
path.
In place.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
And then probably a year later or less than a year, for the first time in history, there were massive layoffs in the school system.
Right.
It happened before. That was supposed to be a secure job. So now I was out of a job. What was I going to do? I was determined I was not moving back home.
Right.
I didn't want to drop out of school. I started looking for waitress jobs. Now, I had never waited tables before, so I was rejected right and left. And I was desperate. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had a friend, a neighbor right on the same floor, whose uncle was a manager for Howard Johnson's. I don't think they exist anymore.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, but it was a restaurant. Think of like a Friday mm-hmm. or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, totally.
Or Denny's, something
yes,
like that.
Yes.
So I asked him, so she put me in touch with him. I met with him and he said, oh, well, unfortunately, we don't have any job openings. And I said to him, well, if I don't get a job, I'm going to lose my apartment. I'm going to have to drop out of school. So he had pity on me and he gave me a job.
Brilliant.
I was working in the middle of Times Square before it was...
You used your language. You used yes. your ability and your skills to sell through. I love that.
Persuasion, but it was yes. more desperation.
That's okay.
So here I was working in Times Square and I would eat my meals on the weekends because they would give you free meals.
Of
and
course.
The week I would eat things like rice and frozen vegetables or salads, cheap meals. And if things were really tight, I'd go home and visit my mother for a meal.
Whatever works.
So
yes.
what that allowed me to do, oh, here's the other thing that I did because I wanted to keep my apartment. My cousin was getting married in 6 months. So I made her a deal. I said, look, why don't you move in for 6 months with me in my studio? You'll save 6 months on rent because you'll be paying half of what I'm paying. And she went for it. I knew she would because she's a little thrifty.
That's okay. Being thrifty, though, at this young stage in life is so important.
Yes.
You were cobbling together all that you needed to do to stay on your path and to continue pursuing what use could see ahead of you.
Right. And to stay in my power.
That's it.
The time I wasn't thinking like that. It was just, I was so desperate. And what I realized when I look back is I'm often better when I'm on the edge and I have right. choice. It's got to work. So she stayed for 6 months. End result was I kept my apartment. I never missed a rent payment. I didn't drop out of school. I got my degree and I got a job. Now, the other blessing to this is at that time, Columbia required your internship to be during the day. Had I had a full-time job, I would not have been able to do that. And I was wondering, how am I ever going to do this? And I just didn't worry about it. I just kept barreling around. So here was the universe pushing me into something that I didn't.
Right.
And it allowed me to finish my dream. So what I've learned about dreams and detours is sometimes it's not a straight path. And most times it's not.
No.
Take those detours. They're often detours you wouldn't have chosen for yourself.
Absolutely. Well, that's the purpose behind the show. It was like the way, you know, the whole point is, you know, the life we're living versus the one that we plan to have. And I think what we can say at any given stage, even at a young stage, clearly you get to say this as well. The best laid plans are always tossed up in the air and we're really not in control the way that we want to be or that we believe that we should be. Mm-hmm. And that surrendering to all that's possible is really important. So something interesting that you said, you felt that you were desperate making choices and decisions out of a place of, I just want to hold on. I just mm-hmm. don't want to lose what I have, my apartment, you know, my education, so on and so forth. But it's really not much different. At least to me, it doesn't seem much different. You know, hindsight is 20/20. And when we look back, we can put language to things that in the moment we could not describe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were a deeply empowered person, even if that wasn't something that you would have used to describe yourself, those words.
Mm-mm, no.
Clearly, there was something already instilled in you, a belief system, a structure, if you will, that was a part of your day-to-day. It was a part of your machinery that was allowing you to propel forward and really accomplish and make it happen. I mean, how random your cousin was going to get married and could use the split budget, you know, that really helped you, and how amazing that you were able to tenaciously, you know, sell through this idea, please hire me because I need this. Not everyone gets those breaks. So there was definitely something that you emitted to those around
Yes,
you.
Also. And then the ability to connect the dots and see the opportunities. Okay,
for sure.
Do this and this. And yeah.
So I think that's brilliant. And clearly a lot of what I don't doubt goes into the work that you do, you know, to a degree with your clients today. Tell me a little bit about where that comes from. Tell me a little bit about where that was instilled in you and what that upbringing was like. Because I would also imagine moving around from place to place, you know, there's a collective, I don't want to use maybe armor, but there's a certain kind of shielding perhaps that you have if you are not staying long and, you know, you need to make new friends, go to new places and such. And so what did that structure look like for you growing up and moving back?
Well, it was hard in a way because every 3 years you left your friends and you had to make new friends. So of course you would cry and be sad. But I developed such a curiosity for people, about people, and especially foreign cultures. And I love that. I can be in a cab, and if I can't place the accent, or if I can, I want to know, where are you from? And that's very exciting to me. And you learn so much about people when you ask them about their own culture. So I've always been curious, and I think I bring that quality to the work that I do. I want to know about people and what makes them tick. It's just...
That's exciting. I love that. Yeah. And so growing up, you moved. So there was this, you know, there was a little bit of sadness, but you really used it again to your benefit to meet new people and to have a new group of friends. Going back to the original comment about not having a Brooklyn accent, was that just really due to the environment, or was that on purpose?
It was due to the environment.
Okay.
There were a lot of Southerners when we were on the army base in Germany. And so when I came home, one of my aunts said, "You sound like you have a Southern accent."
Oh, great.
I was picking that up. But I will say it was intentional. Once I got back to New York, I didn't want to change the way it was sounding. So sometimes people make fun of me. But the one thing I would say is I got used to being the new girl in class, which I think makes me adaptable, because I went to 8 elementary schools, 8 different schools. And at a certain point, I got to like being the new girl in class.
You embrace it. Absolutely. Right. So, you know, you and I shared, I think, in one of our first conversations, I went to 3 elementary schools, a junior high and 2 high schools. I did a lot of moving, and it wasn't because I had a father who was, you know, in the service, but we did move around a bit. And so I share that with you. You do need to learn to embrace it after a while as a young person and see the advantages. And get comfortable there quick, very quick.
I think, you know, yes. And I think travel is so important. It is, I think, the best education beyond a college degree, the ability to travel. And I see people isolating in their little neighborhoods and they don't go outside and they're at such a disadvantage.
I agree.
To see the world. And sometimes even in New York, you know, we are an international city and you think you have everything here, but it can be narrow too.
Absolutely.
You leave the city and you go to the Midwest and it's very different, or the South. And, you know, we see this all the time, and we need to get out of our everyday lives. And
I agree. I'm a huge fan of travel. In the last 2 years, I've gone across the country by myself on road trips, back, you know, in one direction and then returning in a different pathway back. I do, like you, enjoy speaking to people. I'm always curious where someone comes from, or just what their community culture is like. I think those connections only fortify us. Mm-hmm. Why guess when you can have the experience or the conversation head on with someone?
It makes life so much more interesting.
It does. It does. It does. I really enjoy that. So talk to me a little bit about the lessons that were instilled in you growing up that helped you to not only see that for instance, you said you've corrected people when they were speaking growing up. So there was something
that doesn't make you popular.
It doesn't make you popular. You're right, because not everyone enjoys to be, you know, corrected. However, you had you were instinctive in that you wanted to become an English teacher, but you've taken this path that's really quite similar because you're teaching people and you're using all of those brilliant skills. But talk to me a little bit about the foundation of where that comes from and what that looked like, and just structurally what that was about.
The foundation of?
Of your upbringing, like things, you know, lessons instilled in you and a structure to live by, and how much influence that impacted your life and your choices and the way that you chose to live.
Well, certainly the military family made a big impact. My father retired as a lieutenant colonel in the Army, and my sister retired as lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. So I'm the entrepreneur, but it was in our blood, and you know, we speak that language. And so you learn certain things. Discipline certainly was one of them. And my father was a stickler. And as a child, if he said to be home at 7 p.m., he didn't mean 7:05. And so I have this internal clock in me. In fact, I once called someone, I think we had a 10 o'clock call. So I look at the computer, it's 10, I call. And he said, I could set my watch to you.
I love that.
Am very punctual. And I just met someone the other day, and she said she grew up in a similar home, but they told her, if you're on time, you're late. So I value time. I respect people's time. So what I do is I get to a place an hour early, and I'll go have a cup of tea, I'll relax, and then I'm ready so that I don't have any problems with traffic. But so that was one of the lessons. Certainly respect and curiosity for others was part of that as well. Sometimes it was overdone. For instance, I remember when we first were going to Germany, I think I was 8, and my mother said something like, now you need to be on your best behavior because after all, you're representing your country. I thought, really? I'm an 8 ambassador? You know, please. But that was expectation. So high expectations, work ethic, all of those things. But, and you know what, the other thing that's really ingrained into me is the power of a promise. My father, when you made a promise, that was sacrosanct, and don't dare ever go back on a promise. So for that reason today, I do not give many promises because I know I won't go back on it.
Yeah.
It's like ultra commitment for me if I say I promise.
I think that's admirable. I mean, I feel like we've become a little bit loose in our intention perhaps at times. I think that, and it's such a strange analogy, but it's almost like when divorce became acceptable as opposed to please try or mm-hmm. you know, stay with it, when things became, you can cancel it, it's disposable. We turned the corner in this world at a certain point in time and things became disposable. And with it, I sense that everything was so fluid that it didn't matter to either keep your word or to keep a promise or to see something through. It had a fluidness to it that allowed it to sort of go any which way it did. And there was almost a personal responsibility that was detached from it,
right.
Which for you and I, because we're around the same age, we've witnessed that change and that shift. And it's a little unnerving, I'm not going to lie.
Well, I think that's one of the things that makes people trust me, and trust is very important in a relationship, whether you're speaking to an audience, which I do, or whether you're coaching someone one-on-one. So that's one of my strengths. I build trust, people trust me, because I will keep my promise and I do whatever it takes to get you to where you need to be, as long as you're accountable and you're willing to do the work.
Yeah, those are tremendous assets. And I don't doubt that that is exactly what your business is built on. Because let's face it, we can all have a certain skill mm-hmm. to showcase, to translate, and to bring out to the public. But it's really, it becomes about who we are, who we present, and what people get to then learn and trust in us that allows them to take that journey with us.
And I think what else I bring to the table is empathy and intuition. And I think the empathy comes from, again, that early background of meeting so many different people and different cultures. And also the intuition part was not something that was developed or even recognized, but I realize when I work, I'm very good at connecting the dots and I rely on my intuition a lot. So it's, where is this person? And maybe I need to move where they're moving because they're not here right now.
Sure.
That's not something that can be taught. You don't learn that in a classroom or online. It's really tuning into what you're feeling about the other person.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. And I think in my own coaching practice, it, you know, it certainly is a requirement for me in order for me to feel like I am delivering, quite frankly, a service and hearing the person across from me. So I value that as well. So let's fast forward to now, because I'm so impressed and so taken with the work that you do and just the leadership qualities that you have in your business and all of the success that you've been able to create. And it's been some time. It's certainly not new, but you really did take that diversion earlier in your professional space and run with it in such a brilliant way. And so share more about the work you do and all of the amazing tools that you've created and what you can now bring.
Well, one of the tools I'm very proud of is my book, Knockout Presentations, because yes. It's third edition. I wrote it in 1998 and it's still out there, but with a new publisher, Morgan James. And what's great about it is it has such a wide breadth because it can be used with college students, and it has been. And it's been used in the C-suite. So it's like a seminar in a book. I wrote it so that it's the next best thing to being there, being with me. And that's what people tell me. So that's one of the tools that I continually use. Everybody gets a copy when they coach with me. But I've done other things with, I did have an online product, which I have to revamp because it's a little defunct right now, but it was a way to organize a speech online. So we have to rework that. I do a lot of things, whether it's groups or individuals. It's about getting people to that next level, and it's about confidence. So it's about confidence. It's about clarity. It's about credibility. I've worked with ages 4 to 84, literally in my lifetime, and I've worked with starting associates to CEOs. And what I now know is that there is a real return on investment, a hardcore ROI to speaking and presenting. And one example is I worked with a CEO of a pharma company, and he had this very high stakes presentation because he wanted to convince the executive committee to build a vaccine facility. Well, this was going to cost $300 million, and there was no guarantee of success. And then there's 3 years of clinical trials, as we all know. Wow. So really high stakes. But we worked in a coaching capacity. He presented and he got the approval. But the great part of the story is that down the road, that $300 million investment turned into a $1 billion success. So imagine, had he not had the skills, the speaking skills, the persuasive skills, the influencing skills to convince them, they would have missed out on that profit.
Absolutely.
Helped people save their jobs because there was somebody who was at high risk. He was a senior VP of tax and he just couldn't present his recommendations to the CEO. We reworked it. He was able to do that and he stayed on.
You do get this chance.
Hope to people. I want to give hope to people that you can do this. You can turn it around. A lot of times it's two things really, Susan. It's mindset and skill set.
That's what I was going to ask you. Like where are the weaknesses or what is it that you have been able to identify in others that they're not connecting and where you can come in and be the bridge for them? Like, what is that? What's going on?
Thank you for saying that. I never called myself a bridge, but in a sense I am. And I do help people literally create bridge statements and conversations, but it's mindset and skill set. That's the simplest formula I can give you. So the first thing is everything that happens is a result of how you're thinking. So we look there. We look at limiting beliefs and we start to change them. So here's a recent success. A woman that I had been coaching over a period of years came in. She's now in a new startup. So she's not the big honcho in the she's in a startup. She's feeling like she doesn't know enough. And she was getting extremely anxious. And she felt like, I don't know enough. I'm not an expert. So as she described what the meetings were, I said, well, you're wearing the wrong hat. You don't want to put on your expert hat. You want to wear your facilitator hat because these meetings one-on-one are more like intakes. You want to know what they're doing. You're asking questions. You're And then you'll come back if you don't know something and make a recommendation. And I said, you excel at that. And when she thought about it, she started to relax. I could see it visibly. So the next session, she came back and said, I told my friend what you said about the facilitator hat. And she said, that's brilliant. Keep seeing her.
But that's just it. You know, I mean, I think we get so lost and so caught up in what we know. I mean, I always say this about educators, quite honestly. I'm an adult learner. I went back to university later in my life and really had a tremendous experience. But it was always fascinating to me. It's like, just because you know a lot doesn't mean that it comes out
Yes. And
actually translates into a learning moment for everyone in front of you. And so that's what it sounds like to me. It's about not what's caught in your head. It's just the best funnel to use in a given moment, depending on who your audience is and how to then get it out to make it a learning moment.
Yes, it's made such a difference. So very simply put, I work with mindset and skill set. And if you said, what's the one skill that you use more than anything? I would say reframing, because that's changing how people are perceiving themselves, the situation, the audience, the content. And then it gives people a sense of power. And so a lot of times what happens is you get that fight, flight, fright. And so what people think of when they think of fear, it's forget everything and run. Although we often use a different F word, but it's forget everything.
Yes.
And run. So you're in your animal brain when you're there, and we've all been there. The second level is false evidence appearing real. So now you think of fear as, well, it's not really what I think it is. I'm reacting that way, but that's not really the reality. I have more control than I do. And I think the next level above that is face everything and rise.
Face everything and rise. I like that.
So it's going from the animal brain to the cortex, to the prefrontal cortex, and then faith. So that's where we all need to be, especially today.
I love that. And I really do believe that you're right. It really is just about taking all of what you know and funneling it out and utilizing it in a way that is calm and thoughtful, pausing for a moment. I don't doubt that you're also teaching rhythm and timing of speaking, mm-hmm. because all of that is so essential. And I've even found that when I slow down, everything just comes out just the way I planned it, or just the way I'd like it to sound, which makes a tremendous difference. Absolutely.
The power of the pause.
The power of the pause. Don't you love that?
We work a lot on that because people don't realize. I had someone when I was faculty of NYU, I was teaching a course, and this one young man, he was about 23, 24, worked for a top accounting firm. And he said to me, there's one reason I took this course. And that's because when the partners ask me questions, I freeze. And so I watched what he was doing. And I told him, why do you have the knee-jerk response? You don't have to answer immediately. You can think and take a pause. And that gave him permission. And that simple act of breathing and taking a pause before you answer empowered him.
Exactly.
It's little things.
It is. And it reminds me of the way in which I might help a client reduce their anxiety when they're caught up, let's say, in commuting, or life is just building up for them and they're about to snap. It's breathing techniques, right, that we'll bring mm-hmm. into the space to just immediately change the way that their brain is behaving and the way that their heart rate is going mm-hmm. in that particular moment, just to take it down so they can rethink the agitation and let go of mm-hmm. it. It's very similar to preparing someone to speak, or in this case, pause, because that is okay. It's amazing how we aren't yes. given that message or that indication that it's okay to do things like that.
No, it's hurry up.
Yeah. And it's funny. I, in my own life, have realized that often I need to sleep on things. And it wasn't until I made that distinction that I started to make better decisions, because mm-hmm. I was very rapid to decide in a moment and use my impulse as my answer and then want to change my mind, or at least think it through and modify the response. And now I just take my time. And so I find
that's so key, Susan, in conflict resolution.
Yes.
are upset, you're emotional, give it 24 hours and yes. then back, because you are not going to say the right thing. You're going to make yourself even worse off.
Yes.
If you think through what you want to say.
So question for you, when you find yourself in your own personal space of your life, things are not in your control. They're not in the structure of what you, where you're used to working from. Mm-hmm. It's the time, it's the clock, or it's just the ability to rein something in, or even sometimes I would imagine finding language if you're feeling overwhelmed. How does that work for you, and what does that look like?
What's coming to my mind is the word surrender, and it took me back to a time when I was in the Board of Education. So I'm there 8.5 years, and I'm bored. There's no career path. I don't want to be an administrator, and yet I didn't know what to do. This was hard to make a career change, especially at that time people would see you as an overpaid babysitter, and I had no business skills. So I remember one night falling asleep and saying, God, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. I surrender. Just get me out of here. And after 2 weeks, because I had been reading and going for resume training and whatever, about 2 weeks after I said that, there was an ad in the New York Times for a stand-up entry-level trainer for this presentation, public speaking company. And I auditioned and got the job. So that was my foray into business. And then from there, I went to Salomon Brothers. I got caught in the big crash on Wall Street, and I was out of a job there. So there's another detour. Was not expecting that. Mm-hmm. With a month, I got a better job as an assistant vice president at Drexel Burnham, the investment firm. I was recruiting MBAs for the trading floor. So I got an increase in salary. And again, we know what happened to that company. So within mm-hmm. that was gone. And that's how I started my business.
Okay. So in terms of like all the professional like pitfalls or detours and changes and forks in the road, you were able to always like come back and do that. But I want to know about in the personal space of your life, because we're not always in control, you know? And so are there tools, are there places you go, are there things and resources that you tap into for your own benefit to kind of get you back into where you need to be? I mean, it could be meditation for all I know, but like, where does Diane go when things are a little less structured and things are changing?
I rely on my dark chocolate bars.
Ah, I love it.
I'm actually off them for now because I was eating too many of them. But so in my personal life, where I have no control is my husband has end-stage kidney disease, which means he needs a kidney. He goes to dialysis 3 times a week, and it's not a substitute. It just keeps you alive. So we are on 2 lists, but in New York, the waiting list is years, and we are looking for a live donor. So what have I done? I've done what I can do, from t-shirts to standing outside the Today Show with signs to billboards in Times Square to I just started a blog. He has a Facebook page. I mean, there's so many different things. I have a posse, you know, that posse came out with me at the Today Show and we all wore the t-shirts.
That's brilliant.
So what I do is I reach out to friends. I realize that's so important. I'm always reaching out on a phone or in person. And what I realize now with the recent coronavirus, which is very frightening for everybody, I'm taking more walks. Sunday was a beautiful sunny day. It was a little cool, but the sun was warm. I went to a local park and I walked, and just being in nature and having the sun on my face and being quiet and being alone was really restorative and healing. So that is what I'm going to be doing more of, because I realized how important that is. I do meditate 20 minutes every morning.
Wonderful.
I find that being in nature is even more health to me.
You and I are so alike, because I returned home a few days ago from a 2+ week trip of business and pleasure. And the first thing I did on the sunny weekend day, the same as you, I went to my local park where I enjoy a run or a walk. And I as well enjoy the peacefulness of nature. I can think, I can recalibrate, and just be. Mm-hmm. Just be. Good ideas will come to mind. I'll take my phone out and I'll write them down, or just good thoughts. And it is a meditative experience.
When it is.
Right? I love that. Yeah, no, I love that because, and I love asking of others what they might do when they're not trying to drive the bus or when things are not in their control, because I really believe that so many others have that experience. And while many know where to turn or what to do, so many people still are trying to figure it out. So each time we share our experience or what might be working for us, we're hopefully kind of connecting with somebody who's listening and who might find, oh, I'm going to try that. Or, oh, that's what I do too. You know, and that's affirming in such a positive way.
Yeah. So I'm in a number of Facebook groups, and when you hear people's responses, oh, I'm not the only one. So that's helpful. But I have a cousin who listens really well. And if I'm really upset, I will call her and she'll listen. And that's all you want most of the time.
That's it.
So having even just one person who does that and who can do it well. And there are certain people I know I can't call because it will not work.
Right. So, right. No, it's not the place to deposit your thoughts. I understand this.
Yeah. So, and you know, when I had pets, I've had a Chihuahua and three cats. When I had them, they were really healing. You know, you cuddle with them, they make you feel good. We don't have them right now, and by choice, because I'm the caregiver for my husband and I don't want to take on another life.
Yeah.
But that I find animals. If I see people walking them, I stop and pet them because they're just adorable.
Yeah, that is. It's a beautiful connection. It's all love and pure with animals. I agree with you. So yeah, this is exactly, you know, your story I was already fascinated by, and I really wanted the listeners to hear more about who you are and what you do, because I think at any time in our life when we are hitting the wall and we have to reinvent or just sort of redeploy our intention and our pathway. You are a wonderful example of that.
Thank you.
Tremendous integrity and tenacity. I love and admire that part of you among others. And I really wanted people to know more about what you do and the work that you're putting out there. And of course the book, because as far as I'm concerned, when you are a leader in your field, if you can put out a tool that becomes available for everyone, then, you know, you're really saying, I can work with you on a level, even if it's not that one-to-one or in your corporation, but you, the individual, can certainly tap into what I can share and what I can change. So thank you for that. And thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I think these times are really trying and it calls for a lot of resilience. And I, like everybody else, I don't know what's going to happen with the coronavirus, but I'm trying to stay calm, reach out and think, what's next? How do we work this?
That's right.
You know, what are the blessings? Because I've seen posts from people online saying, oh, I'm spending more time with my children. So we have an opportunity here as well. If we
do
recognize it.
That's right. We're community building in a whole new way. And I honestly look forward to having more of these video calls with others, but I agree with you. We are being reset and we are being taught something in this moment. And I think if we can all just take that away, we'll be wiser and we'll it'll be more. It'll be all
we'll be
more
okay.
that we are looking for. Absolutely. Absolutely. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Susan. I really enjoyed talking to you.
That's it for this episode of Dreams and Detours. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe and share it with your friends. You can find me at dreamsdetours.com and at dreamsdetours on Instagram. Thanks for listening.